Good evening and welcome to another episode of Nigeria Politics Weekly. As usual, my name is Michael and co-hosting with me is Phoenix. Today we're going to be discussing three topics. First of all, we'll discuss reports that former governor or the suspended governor of the central bank, Godwin Emefiele, has been finally charged by the DSS, the State Security Services. Secondly, we'll discuss the announcement by Bola Tinubu's government that a state of emergency has been declared in the food sector. And thirdly, we'll discuss reports in the papers that Bola Tinubu might drop some of his cabinet nominees because of corruption allegations against them. So, Phoenix, so the first topic, Godwin Emefiele has been charged, but according to the reports, he's been charged for illegal possession of firearms. Is that it? Is that why we had all this drama? Because of illegal possession of firearms, Phoenix? Can you talk us through what is happening?
Hi, Michael, and hello, listeners. Thanks for joining us again. Michael, you know, as they say in our parlance, you get as you do. This is just... I remember last week when we were talking about Tinubu's first month in office, and while we were talking about security, for some reason, I had had it in my mind that I wanted to touch on this subject of Emefiele being under arrest by the DSS and what it means about Tinubu's respect for rule of law, and why he was going down this path, which clearly seemed to me to be one pursuing a vendetta. And I mean, this news story for me only further confirms that. Why do I say that? When DSS first went after Emefiele in December 2022 and they were shopping for a court order and couldn't get one, the charges what they were accusing him of back then was sponsoring terrorist activities. They said he was a sponsor of IPOB. They said he was providing funds for terrorist activities. They accused him of mismanaging CBN and a CBN subsidiary. They accused him of mismanaging the Ankoborua funds. So there was clear, you know, when we hear anti-terrorism is a serious, serious deal. I mean, not only does it require significant attention locally, it also requires, you know, it brings attention internationally. So that was, I guess they were looking for sensationalism to pursue him there. But the other part of it were financial crimes. And people like me were like, if you're accusing him of financial crimes, why not get the EFCC to go after him? But they couldn't, you know, do anything at that point in time. Then they picked him up, you know, after he was suspended by Tinubu and have held him for over a month. There's a court order that then demanded that he be released, he be either charged to court or released within 1 week. And then these guys show up by saying that they're charging him for possession of firearms. And when they say possession of firearms, they're talking about one single barrel shotgun and a handful of, no, let me not say a handful, I mean bullets, which is beyond ridiculous to have your DSS, the State Security Service, going after one individual for the possession of one gun. I can understand if he had a cachet of arms. If you caught him with a cachet of arms, I can understand. But to the extent that it's one gun, that's a police matter at best. That should have been something referred to the police to say this guy has an unlicensed firearm. It's clearly against the law and they quoted the law, but that's a police matter. That doesn't come into the realm of State Security Service. It just tells you that these guys were throwing mud, hoping that something will stick. They haven't gotten anything to stick. They needed to be able to continue to hold him. And so they jumped at, you know, something that they felt would give them you know, the opportunity to continue to hold him. And it's just right up the alley of the APC. I continue to say that we will not let Tinubu divorce himself or try to distance himself from Buhari's disastrous regime. This is a continuation. The abuse of human rights, of due process, the abuse of the rule of law, make no mistake about it. I am one that believes that Emefiele and Buhari should pay for the economic crimes and economic sabotage against this country. They practically destroyed our economy over 8 years of the worst policies we've seen. Even Abacha and his gang did not come as close to what these guys did. So I believe very strongly that he should pay for that. But it needs to follow due process. We need to be a country of that respects the rule of law. And from the moment that this guy was picked up and they started all of this nonsense, I was like, you know, this is what Nigerians are going to get from the Tinubu administration. So, I mean, DSS, they're bunglers in chief, and I mean, they've done it again.
Thank you, Phoenix. But I suppose the question is, how do they explain these things to the international community? Bola Ahmed Tinubu was in France a few weeks ago telling the international media that Godwin Emefiele had been suspended and arrested because of serious financial infractions and that there was so much damage he did to the system. So they built up this crescendo, So how are they, or are they not even bothered about explaining themselves to the international community, the global financial markets? How do you say you just arrested your central bank governor and now it's because he owns a gun? Is that what all this was done for? Or is there more to this than meets the eye?
I mean, there's clearly more to this than meets the eye. We've obviously been talking about that. I remember an episode where we're talking about the fact that, I mean, this will be a shakedown. At some point, there'll be a deal that'll be caught and all of that. I mean, you know, when you've flown the first kite of terrorism, you know, everybody's mind goes to, whatever you want to do with this guy, do with him, nobody cares. International community are willing to turn a blind eye once you start flying that kite of terrorism. The question now is, with this new charge, are people paying sufficient attention enough to remember that, no, this is different from what was initially said, and then what happens in that regard? So it remains to be seen how far they want to push this firearms issue. But I don't think that this means that this is over. I believe that they needed time to continue to hold him, and they're still looking for, you know, different ways to continue to lean on this guy and find more weightier things to do. But it just showed how ill-prepared, how unintelligent these guys can be, that, you know, having initially conceived a plan to go after this guy back in December, and then waiting until June to pick him up, you had almost 6 months. Surely you could have built a case. You could have gotten a lot more than a simple firearm to hold him against after all of this time that you've been on the matter. So it just shows that, I mean, the incompetence and just the lack of capacity to even do, you know, bad things, you know, in a way that makes sense. So, I mean, it's shameful, really. Very, very shameful.
So, Phoenix, so the rumors we've heard, I don't know if there's any truth to them. So the rumors we heard is that the reason why Bola Tinubu is unwilling or incapable of bringing more serious charges against Emefiele is because it will open up a can of worms. He apparently has a dossier on people as high up as even the former president himself, probably some members of Bola Tinubu's family and wider APC network. Apparently, they're all involved in whatever infractions Emefiele has been accused of running. So, do you think there's truth to this? Do you think that's probably the reason why they cannot actually charge him for the things they claim he's done?
I believe there's some truth to that. And I alluded to that, you know, recently when we're discussing that. Look, this guy, I remember I talked about him having a potentially having a compromise, and which allows him to have a hold on a large number of people. Let's not forget, Emefiele was central bank governor for 8 years. Emefiele ran for 8 years an FX regime that lost Nigeria trillions of naira. That put, it was like the biggest private world public to private world transfer that we've ever seen in our history. You know, people basically were just making money, you know, sitting down somewhere, just you just get access to FX, you take it from government, from CBN rate to black market rate, and you're turning around billions of naira. So think about all the people who had access, who went to him, and he was able to make wealthy or create wealth for, you know, which was what led him to think that he was invisible, that he had become a strong member of the establishment and therefore could make a run for the presidency while sitting in the CBN governor's office. It was that hubris that led him to that. So clearly he has a list of the people, of his counterparties, of all the people that he worked with, that he enabled. And so that makes him dangerous in the sense that, number one, he potentially has a significant war chest that boy Tinubu was worried about, or, you know, some people around Tinubu or Tinubu himself were willing to, you know, shake down to make sure some of those trillions of naira that have been, you know, screwed away, you know, find their way into other private pockets. Or this idea of him being able to expose people to create problems, perhaps for Tinubu himself, perhaps for a Buhari, definitely for Buhari's kitchen cabinet, because we know that he was in cahoots with them. We know how close he was to the late Issa Fontoua and Maman Daura and the likes. So, and so there must be a reason why it's not easy for them to simply let him go scot-free, without making sure that they've gotten the necessary assurances and, you know, reached a deal that ensures all parties feel covered. It might also explain how the charges can go down from such a height of anti-terrorism to possession of a firearm, which more than likely is easy to then give him a slap on the wrist because you've made another deal backdoor to make sure everything is kosher. So there's definitely a lot of sense, a lot of probability to the rumors that we're hearing, that there's more to it, and Emefiele will be playing his cards to make sure that he's protected and can get out of this in one piece.
So I suppose the next question then, Phoenix, is what happens next? The central bank governor is suspended. You have an acting governor. Is the plan to get Emefiele to resign, or
he will have to resign? There's no doubt about it. If he has clearly broken the law, it is untenable for him to remain central bank governor. So this is a path for him to resign. He has to resign. And even if he doesn't resign, just by being convicted of this would mean that the National Assembly will therefore have to, you know, play ball and remove him permanently.
Well, I suppose that's my point, Phoenix, because, you know, the Nigerian judicial system grinds very slowly. So are you saying we're going to just wait for the next 9 months with a suspended central bank governor? Is it not possible for them to just tell him now, say, look, just resign? And why can't they just... Why is Tinubu delaying this thing?
I don't think the issue is about... number one, I don't think Emefiele can resist a request for him to resign. I do not think that that is what is holding this up. That cannot be what is holding this up. If they want him gone, if they want him to resign, he'll resign. There's enough to go on to make that happen. I believe it's the bigger issue of he resigns and then what? He resigns, you know, and does he still have a case over him? He resigns and is there an agreement, an alignment on how things go forward? But I think in terms of changing him and moving him out of the office, I do expect that that's going to happen sooner rather than later. We're definitely not going to go 9 months, you know, waiting for this guy to do what he needs to do. I believe it's past that. I mean, there's no path for him back to the CBN governor's office. So why would he be holding on and refusing to resign? And he knows that, I mean, at some point, if they really want him out, they will get it done through the National Assembly. I mean, come on. So you talk to Godzilla, Fabio, I mean, you get the votes that you need and do the deal that you need to make to get him removed. I believe that there's bigger issues that they are trying to resolve beyond that.
And then the final question on this topic is with regards to the credibility of the central bank and the Nigerian government. Because the way this matter has been handled, I think a number of objective observers can clearly see that there's politics behind the maneuvering. I mean, a few months ago, I was at a party with a former Nigerian government minister, and he mentioned that Emefiele was actually told by Buhari to run for office. So it wasn't Emefiele's idea to turn up or to apply for the APC ticket, according to this minister who served in Buhari's government. It was Buhari that told him to go and run for office. So on the one hand, you have a central bank governor seeking the presidential ticket of a member of the political party whilst not resigning. And you now have a president who is basically suspending him, accusing him of all kinds of infractions, and then charging him for possession of a firearm. So I suppose the question is, how do you repair the credibility of the CBN, especially as, particularly with Buhari's government, where Buhari seemed to be running monetary policy from Aso Rock? Do you think Bola Tinubu is the person, or do you think he will sort of restore the credibility of the central bank, Phoenix?
I don't think he will. I think to the extent that to the extent that he chose to suspend the central bank governor without any clear indication of the infractions, and now we're seeing them talk about firearm possession, tells you that this guy is not the kind of person that brings credit, because that removes credibility from the central bank. Because we all agree and we all know that by law the central bank is supposed to be independent, and therefore any disciplinary action, the law specifies how that should happen. But even if you're going to suspend, which I believe the president has the right to ask a central bank governor to step aside, if there are clear allegations, you know, that make it untenable for the person to remain in office while you are investigating. Now, those allegations, Tinubu has not told us, you know, what was the reason for the suspension. He came out and said the economy under him or the financial system under him was a disaster. I'm sorry, that makes no sense. That's not an allegation. You can say the person was incompetent, but then you can go through, you know, a number of channels. Yeah, I mean, for you to correct that wrong, if you believe he's not fit for office, then you go to the National Assembly and but to suspend him and ask him to step aside must mean that you believe that he had done something wrong. And more than just wrong, it had to be a proper malfeasance, you know, from either a financial crime or like they were saying at that time, a terrorist claim. Now, it's making it look like you are shopping for a crime to tie him to, and therefore you have removed the credibility of your government and of the central bank by acting that way. The second point for me was he appointed a special assistant on monetary policy, which suggests to me that he wants to have a say in how the central bank is run, in the central bank's core mandate. Again, that is not something that the federal government should be overtly signaling to the market or to the public. And so it tells you where his head is at from a central bank perspective. And bear in mind, this is somebody who we've heard him say things like interest rates are too high, they need to be forced down by fiat. We've heard him say things like, you need to create money to boost the economy, especially when We were facing a recession during the COVID era. So this is somebody who has talked about, you know, delinking revenue from budget and all those kind of things. So he has those that mindset of being able to turn the central bank into a piggy bank. So when you add all of that together and the actions that he's taking, less than 2 months in office, it sends significant concerns as to how the central bank will operate with this administration. We saw it under Buhari. Believe me, I think that there's even more risk under Tinubu, given how he has acted so far.
Thank you, Phoenix. Well, we must move on to the next topic. President Bola Ahmed Tinubu has declared a state of emergency in the food sector. But to many observers, it's not quite clear what he's announced. So I suppose that's the first question to you, Phoenix. What exactly is this food state of emergency? How does it work, Phoenix?
I mean, I start by saying, I mean, what does it mean to declare a state of emergency? And typically what happens that you do that? You do that when, you know, normal policy-making processes are not sufficient to effect the turnaround that you need within the time frame that you need it. You know, things have broken down significantly that you need to put a stop to everything and say, look, we are putting a stop to everything, and now we're going outside of our normal standard realms of policy making and want to really effect an immediate turnaround in events. You typically find it in times of war, in times of significant economic depression and things like that, that yes, you declare a state of emergency because you want to effect a quick turnaround. Now, should there be a state of emergency declared on food security and all of that? Yeah, absolutely. When you look at the facts on ground, when you look at food inflation above 20%, when you look at clear issues that we have around, you know, around food security in Nigeria, around availability and affordability for the most of the people, it makes sense that, yes, you come in with that sense of urgency and you try to effect a turnaround with a considered, thoughtful, and clearly planned approach. Now, where I begin to struggle is in the details. So, okay, you've declared a state of emergency, we've heard that. What exactly do you then plan to do? And so we begin to look at the plan and say, how much of this really makes sense and can be delivered? And then for me, what are therefore the building blocks that lead you to measurable outcomes that we can begin to, you know, talk about in short order? Again, when I look at his 12-point plan, I'm looking at the post that he himself made on Twitter, you know, with key points of his intervention plan and blah, blah, blah. Some of the things, you know, make sense, you know, about, you know, things that you want to quickly do to trigger a response. But some of it, again, you find challenging. I call out a couple. You know, when I start hearing things like, you know, creation of a national commodity board for price assessment and maintenance of strategic food reserve, those things concern me. Any point where you begin to see a government trying to control price, you know that it cannot go well, because the moment you start trying to, you know, we've seen it. That's what led to subsidy, because we're trying to control the price of fuel products. That once you start trying to do things like that, you create an artificial market. You need to let the market operate. The market, when you let the market operate, it spurs investment, it spurs innovation, it spurs, you know, the positive outcomes that you're looking for. Of course, you need to do certain things to make sure that the market operates within a sound environment, but you don't just jump quickly and say, I want to start, you know, dealing with price and things like that. The other thing that worried me was, you know, talking about central bank's role in funding agricultural value chain. For me, that again fundamentally is wrong. Those were the kinds of things that I railed against, you know, under Buhari and Emefiele. Central bank turning itself into an intervention driven organization instead of focusing on its mandate and allowing the financial sector, the banks, and all those kinds of things to do the intervention. So, you know, there's some things that make sense. A lot of it doesn't make sense. And that's where, for me, you begin to say, you want to declare, it's okay to make a pronouncement about declaring state of emergency, but we want to see throughput, we want to see the thinking and the plans, and make sure this is not just another, you know, joke of a plan that that goes nowhere.
Thank you, Phoenix. Thank you for explaining the, giving an overview. The first question a number of people have asked is, wouldn't you usually need a Minister for Agriculture, Minister for Finance, and maybe a Minister for Budget and Planning before you begin to declare a state of emergency? Or is that, are those positions not necessary, Phoenix?
I mean, the APC way is to tell us that those are noisemakers, right? Where he started, and now we're seeing Tinubu further the thing in terms of trying to effect significant policy initiatives without executive presence that allows it the things to be done in a clear and measurable manner. Why do you need ministers? It's like running a private enterprise and saying you only need a CEO and you don't need an executive leadership team for the different, you know, functional areas of the business. One, you cannot have one person be the only executive leader, be the only direction setter for the entire organization. Number two, you need a brain trust. You need people who are experienced, senior enough to bring things to the table and who have a broader remit than, you know, typical narrow remit that you have career civil servants will typically have. You need to bring in, like you are saying, expertise from outside, people who have done this before, who know and can bring that to the table for you. So to the extent that he's doing this with his coterie of special advisors and with now bear in mind, this is not somebody who has operated centrally before. He's never had a ministerial appointment at the center. He's practically learning the ropes of how the federal government works, even though he was a state governor for 8 years and party. He doesn't understand how Abuja works, how the federal government apparatus works. And so when you start doing things like this without, you know, a team that is put in place to then go and lead those functional areas and can day-to-day, those guys will be day-to-day driving the policy, you know, requirements in their areas. It's not going to be special advisors that are going to be doing that. They create a cog in the wheel because the people who are career civil servants know that these guys are not there for the long run. They know that your special advisors are like stopgaps. So how much information are they going to be giving to them? How cooperative is the apparatus going to be, knowing that this is not the defunct leader and this is not the person that is going to actually be running the show? So it's again part of the, you know, form, not substance approach that, I mean, the APC seems to be well known for, and it seems like Tinubu is also following the same template. You know, by now, what we thought was that this was a guy that would hit the ground running and give us his list of nominees and ensure that the Senate, I mean, you are walking into, again, it reminds me of the Buhari situation, walking into a clear, economically challenging timeline and doing nothing for 6 months and then wondering why we fell into a recession in 2016. It's the same thing. You knew you were coming into a situation where that was challenging. We had high inflation. We had we had government finances in the mess. We're spending on interest almost every single naira that we earn. But you're walking into that situation without a team, without a clear sense of urgency to drive things. And when you set up a state of emergency, you're right, Michael. I mean, who are the people who are going to drive this and make sure that this actually gets done?
Thank you, Phoenix. So for the time being, based on the announcement that was made, did they specify who amongst his advisors is the person taking responsibility for implementing this policy? Was that mentioned at all?
I haven't seen any name in any of the notes. And I'm trying to remember if there was anybody specifically named as special advisor for agriculture. I don't recall. I know that, I mean, like I was saying before, there's somebody for monetary policy, there's somebody for revenue, and things like that. Well, I don't remember. Probably there is somebody for agriculture, and we'll see. Well, it could again be lip service, right? So we'll see where they go with this drama that they've got.
Well, I suppose so. You talked about the Food Commodities Board, and this reminds me of something. Wasn't this something in the old Western region when Nigeria was still adopted a regional style government, when the Action Group were in power in the Western region? Didn't they have these sort of commodities boards that regulated the prices of food?
Yes, they did. And to what effect? Were they effective? I mean, we all know that the Western government was pseudo-socialist. I mean, that was basically the agenda of our law back then. And you know, price fixing. I mean, even if you could get away with it to some extent, you know, in the 1960s, and we're in 2023, it makes absolutely no sense to bring that back now. What are the commodity boards supposed to solve for? The issue is not the issue is not price. The issue is if I was trying to solve for food security, there'll be, to my mind, four things I need to focus on. One for me is insecurity. We all know that the insecurity is a huge factor in the amount of crop yield. Why? Because we have wide swaths of arable land that our farmers cannot access because of the either banditry or ISWAP or Fulani herdsmen. That's a major issue. So that's one thing that you need to solve for. You need to solve for storage, which is huge. Storage, because we have poor storage facilities, it's creating issues for, you know, produce comes out, is harvested, but a large chunk of it is lost because there's no storage. So it means that you're only sending a small portion of what is being harvested to the market. That's why cost goes up, because you don't have enough to go to the market. And then even going to when you lose some to storage, you lose some to transportation. So your transportation network, the way we get the produce from farm to market, is also a problem that you need to solve for. You know, then for me, the final point is around land rights. The Land Use Act is a major issue in this country. It affects also access to land for people who want to truly go into farming, because we need to move away from subsistence farming to, you know, people setting up agricultural combines. People say, you know, large investments in agriculture across the entire value chain. But if land rights are an issue, if storage, which again links to power, is an issue, if transportation network, roads and rail and all those things are an issue, if insecurity is an issue, what exactly are you solving for? So you need to understand the clear issues and tackle them directly for you to be able to, you know, carry out whatever you say you're trying to do. And some, a lot of these things are not going to be things that happen overnight. Some things you can enable to immediately begin to happen. You know, yes, you know, you release fertilizer. Yes, you create a funding mechanism for people to be able to access funding. But the key issues need to be solved for.
Thank you, Phoenix. On the practical front, this attempt at sort of setting the price of food centrally by the government, what do you think the practical implications are? Because we saw that when this APC government under Buhari tried to set the price for the Naira and said, regardless of what market forces were saying, $1 would be about 300 and I think it was 300 and something Naira. And we saw how that went. Is that what you expect to happen with food prices, or if you were forecasting, what would your predictions be?
You're going to make it. It's only going to lead to higher prices, because all will happen is that once you start setting prices, you create arbitrage, because some people will have. A few people will have access to the agricultural produce at government prices. They will go create a secondary market and make it more expensive. And then you create middlemen, you create all of this, avenues for corruption. The moment you start trying to artificially, create or impact a market, people will find ways around it quite naturally to create profit for themselves. We've seen it many, many, many times. We've seen it happen. So, you will create scarcity, the price will go up, it will become much worse than it is today. Because government is naturally inefficient, and the Nigerian government is even 1,000 times more inefficient than the most inefficient government you can think of at allocating, economic resources. Doing this kind of price setting thing, because there will be loopholes, they will not be able to control. And even when you try to control, what kind of a society are you creating? So when you create the commodity boards and you start setting prices and all of those kinds of things, how does it benefit the local farmer? If he can find better prices for his produce, why should he, bring it to the commodity board? So those kinds of things just always create more issues. You need to focus on creating the enabling environment so that we have more people farming, more yield, better storage, better route to market. With more food showing up in the market, price will come down. It is very simple. Nobody needs you to go and fix artificially the price when there's not enough coming through to the market.
I know you've talked a bit about the Land Use Act, but obviously the Nigerian government has said their concern is that food is expensive, especially with the removal of the fuel subsidy. Food prices have also gone up. So you've talked about the Land Use Act, but if you were president tomorrow and they said, okay, Phoenix, your job is to address the high cost of food, what would you do?
I called out the four things I would do. You need to, number one thing for me will be all out insecurity has to be solved for. Our people need to be able to go to the farm and they need to be able to, plant, and have more food produce, more agricultural produce coming out. So that's number one thing. Number two is therefore the things I talked about, storage, working on power and making sure the transportation network to get, from the farms to the market. For me, the bigger issue around bringing investment in, because as I said, we need to move away from more subsistence farming to more, bigger investment in agriculture by the private sector, is to enable through legal reform, to ensure that proper title and proper access to land for people who want to invest, and access land for farming on a large scale, and create incentives for them to come in and to do that effectively. Those are the things I will focus on.
But what about, because a number of economic commentators have said, look, food used to be cheap when Nigerians could just import food, because at some point you just have to accept that somewhere like Thailand can always produce rice cheaper than Nigeria can, or you can import frozen chicken, which would be cheaper than producing the chicken in Nigeria. So why do we still have bans on the importation of food, Phoenix? Why don't we just import? Is that not a solution you would propose?
For me, it's a given that, the reason why I didn't talk about it is because, and I've had this debate with a number of people. The facts are out there and people just, either they choose not to follow, not to, you know, listen to the facts, or they have their own ignorance to blame. Nigeria, even at the best of times, most of our food that we consume in this country comes from this country. So food importation was never a problem. And so for me, it is a given that there must be no ban on food importation. There's no amount of food that you will import into Nigeria that creates a problem. Because if I remember correctly, maybe for 2022, I think I saw the numbers was about 2.2 trillion naira or something like that. That's about maybe 10% of the food that we consume in the country. When I did the numbers the last time, it is inconsequential. So anybody even thinking of, the fact that we had food import bans and all those kinds of things was just ridiculously stupid. It made no sense and, of course, created issue. Because you see, because it's so small that you then create a ban, you create, a big issue out of nothing that then impacts other things. Because think about it, if people are now smuggling rice in, or, you know, bringing it through, and the price of rice is jumping up, or the price of other things, that when they go to market side by side with locally produced cassava and all of those things, do you think that the local farmer or the local market woman will keep her locally sourced garri and all those other things low, even as rice is skyrocketing? No, they won't. That's part of the problem, because you are creating a problem that did not exist. You are banning a small portion that is coming in, driving at higher cost. And then, of course, the knock-on effect is that the people who are selling other things will obviously, you know, you are setting a new price ceiling. It makes no sense. So that's why, for me, it's not even something that comes naturally to me, because for me, it should be a given. It should not even be a subject for debate that we should not have any import bans around food. So you're right, yes, because if you remove those import bans and let things go naturally, you're not creating a problem. You reduce the issues that you have. You focus on the fact that majority of the food that Nigerians consume comes from locally. And so how do you increase the supply of that? By fixing the value chain. So you're right. I mean, those things were just distractions that made no sense, that created more problems than they could ever hope to solve, because people refuse to listen and to follow the data. Data tells us that our food comes majorly from Nigeria.
Thank you, Phoenix. It's been an interesting conversation on this food security. But onto our final topic, which is, we still don't have a cabinet, as we discussed earlier, but in the newspapers, there's speculation that Bola Tinubu might have to drop some of his planned nominees because of corruption allegations surrounding them. Apparently, some names have been sent to the security agencies for vetting, and those names have been rejected because they've been red flagged because of corruption allegations. Now, Phoenix, I was reading the commentary online about the story, and a number of people were skeptical. In your view, are they right to be skeptical that corruption will be the reason that Bola Tinubu drops his nominees? What are your views, Phoenix?
I think I have a number of views on this, and I know we were talking just before we came on the podcast. Number one is, it brings some humor for me to find out that Bola Tinubu actually plans to use corruption allegations as a reason for dropping nominees, given his own checkered history and the allegations that trail him. So, I mean, as we were discussing, maybe it's a ploy for him to make sure that he doesn't have to, you know, all the promises that were made, all the people that he's beholding to, he doesn't have to, you know, come up on that if they can bring strong enough allegations that make it clear that, we can't have, I'll find you something else, but, you know, given this level of stuff, we can't have you. I wait for him to be able to see him do that. The problem is, of course, we've not seen a good enough list come out that we can then say, okay, some people will drop. I think though, when I also think about the delays around his list, I think the way I look at it is, I believe that Tinubu wants to show that he's better than Buhari. And if we look to the kind of cabinet that he set up when he was governor, you know, with a lot of technocrats, with a lot of really smart people back then, maybe he's looking to do something similar. But people are maybe some of those people are a bit reluctant, to the extent that they're not sure what way the tribunal case might go. So there are people that because I'm certain that yes, there will be those from a political bent that he will be looking to pick. There's no doubt in my mind that there will be a number of governors who he needs to, you know, pay back. But he would want to balance that with some people who can put a shine on his government. I doubt that Tinubu would want to, you know, set up a government or a cabinet that is wholly full of political characters that bring no capability or capacity. Now, that second group of people will, you know, they are coming to burnish the credentials, and so they may have more of an ask as to, let's make sure this thing is actually real and makes sense before I fully commit to this adventure. And maybe that is part of it. But in terms of this report that we heard, that he potentially is dropping names due to corruption allegations and all of those kind of things, there may be some truth to it. It fills me with laughter. And it just creates more drama around, you know, this lack of movement that we're seeing, which we thought would not be the case.
Thank you, Phoenix. I suppose the next question is on what grounds could an APC, someone like Bola Tinubu, with given his reputation, how would he even look these nominees in the eyes and say, sorry, I've had to drop you because they said you're corrupt? How would that work?
That's how I said it feels me, it cracks me up. The dossier must be serious. I mean, you jigger. It must be significant for you to be able to tell people, given who you are, that, I mean, this is just not going to work for us. I mean, come on. You're a president who has, you know, a drug related case in your past. I mean, you're a president who, your time in Lagos, even up to now, there are clear allegations of malfeasance. So how do you then turn around and say to people, you know, especially people who played a key role in you emerging, and then tell them that it's because of corruption allegations that you are dropping them? I think for me, I mean, like I said, it fills me with humor. I mean, if he's actually trying that, I mean, I want to see the drama unfold. But it's just interesting. It might just be a kite that someone that they're flying just to create distraction and all of those kinds of things. But, and again, at the end of the day, there are going to be characters he can try it with. There are going to be certainly characters who we all believe have corruption allegations against them, that he will not, you know, dare to, you know, try that with, rather because it will create a more difficult time for him, you know, having those kinds of people now aiming, you know, shots at him. So it remains to be seen. The most important thing is that he should just bring out list. Let us even see the list first.
You know, as on that point, before we talk broadly about the list itself, but surely there are degrees of corruption. So, okay, let's take it as a given that perhaps everybody in his list or on the list might have one or two corruption allegations. But you have the likes of former governor of Kano State, Ganduje, who was caught on camera receiving bribes and putting stuffing them in his outfit. Is it Baba Regatta or Agbada? Surely that is the kind of corruption that even Bola Tinubu would agree that, look, this was caught on 3D camera, so we have to drop you. Do you not think that kind of corruption would even outrage Tinubu?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, they've been close allies and work together. I mean, I don't see how. I mean that's I mean I don't see Tinubu being outraged. I don't see him deciding on that alone. It has to be something significantly more egregious or a political calculation for him to drop a Ganduje. It will not be because of those videos. I mean, we're talking about videos that even, if I remember correctly, even Buhari was saying maybe they were doctored or something like that. So, nah, Tinubu will not look Ganduje in the face and say because of those videos, he's not going to make him a minister. It has to be something more.
Okay, perhaps you might be right, but we'll see. But when the list comes, we'll see. But that brings me to the issue of the list itself, because I think according to the reports, the deadline by which he has to submit the names to the Senate is the 29th of July, because I think there was a constitutional amendment that said you have to nominate your cabinet within, I think, 60 days of you being sworn in, and that'll be on the 29th of July. And today's the 16th, and there's still no sign of this list anywhere. Bola Tinubu told us he was going to hit the ground running. Is this your understanding? Because looking at the news reports, they said, for example, Obasanjo nominated his sent his list within 30 days to the Senate. Goodluck Jonathan did the same thing within 30 days to the Senate. So why is it that Bola Tinubu, who said, like Buhari, interestingly enough, they both said they would hit the ground running. Somehow, Buhari took almost 6 months to send his list, and Bola Tinubu has gone beyond a month. So, what is the problem, Phoenix?
I don't think, I don't, I mean, for me, I don't want to say that it's a problem. I just want, I for me, it's more of an issue of having people who are not fit to be in the office, take office. Buhari was not fit to be president. He had no intellectual capacity to do that job. And we saw the outcome over a period of 8 years. Tinubu was not the was not in the a candidate that should have, come through in this election. He was clearly past his prime intellectually and physically. And so, I mean, this shows a lack of preparedness. You do not run for the presidency of any nation and not immediately know what you plan to do. He had a manifesto. He clearly did not write that manifesto on his own. He must have had a team. He had plans for different sectors of the Nigerian polity. And so he must have, in putting those plans together, also have been thinking of, okay, who's going to help me actualize those plans? There's no reason why, for me, even waiting 30 days to announce, cabinet is too late. As far as I'm concerned, the moment you've been sworn in, put your list out right away. Put your list out right away, because I expect you in the time, number one, even before the election day, you must have idea of at least a third of your cabinet, the most key positions, finance, petroleum, what are those key, power, works and housing, those kinds of key fundamental, policy shaping positions. You must have an idea of two, three candidates for those positions before you go into elections. You have a short list, at least for each one, at least three people. that you would have been engaging and you'd have been talking to. Then you go into elections, you get declared the winner. You have 2 months. So we're talking about from March till May. In those 2 months, you nail down to your final person, you know, do a few interviews, you know, make sure that you are fully confident. But by the day you are being sworn in, you must know, at least for your most crucial positions. We're just talking about, you know, agriculture. We're just talking about his state of emergency plan. If you knew you were going to declare a state of emergency on food security, then that meant to me that you must have known who your Minister for Agriculture was going to be months ago. If you know that, for example, he wrote to the National Assembly asking for a supplementary budget of 800 billion. Yet there's no finance minister. Surely, if you knew that economically there were things that you wanted to do, from a fiscal perspective, there are things that you wanted to do, why didn't you already know who was going to help you to lead the fiscal side? So for me, it just shows a lack of preparedness and confirms a lack of fitness for the job. You don't come into the job and you're faffing around, you know, with what you're doing. I mean, with people who clearly cannot, you know, when you hire a special advisor, the reason why they don't need to go through confirmation is because they cannot wield any constitutional authority. They cannot perform. You know, they can only advise. They cannot make executive choices on your behalf, which is why you need ministers and why those ministers need to go through Senate confirmation, because they're being given authority to act. And so when you don't have those kinds of people, you're practically grinding the business of government to a halt, especially at a time that you need to come in and make sure that the turnaround that we require begins to happen from day one. Now, we're almost 2 months in, you know, with all the chaos that has gone on, you knew you were going to, you know, continue with the decision to stop fuel subsidy. Surely you needed economic managers in place to bring, and we've talked about this on past episodes, to effect, you know, clear plans as to, okay, we're removing this, what are we doing going forward? We're pushing the central bank to collapse FX rates. What are we going to do going forward? How do we, you know, work with the outcome? How do we, you know, these are the different scenarios of what will happen once it's done. And these are the action plans that we need to put in place. We need people to be able to do that. So anyways, as far as I'm concerned, that's where I am. I mean, it's just showing that, I mean, this is not the person that should have been there.
Thank you, Phoenix. I suppose my final question on this topic of his appointees is, of the names being speculated so far, are there any of them who you would be happy to see there? Maybe Wali Adun, or I don't know, would Nasir El-Rufai excite you as a minister? But who would you like to see in his government?
I don't know. I haven't thought about who should be in his government, because I mean, his government, as far as I'm concerned, his government is an illegal one. He didn't win the election, and he shouldn't be in office. So I've just been waiting to see what he does. I'm not going to be giving Tinubu any suggestions as to who he should have in his government. The Wale Edun conversation I've discussed, to my mind, for me, the right place to put him would be like finance or economic planning or things like that, not the central bank, which it seems that was what they were positioning him for. Maybe I'm wrong, I don't know. El-Rufai, for me, should never hold any other public office in this country, given how he has behaved, how his continued heating up of the polity, his sectionalism, his rebranding but he's coming out as a religious fanatic. He should not be anywhere near. We've heard about the likes of Ganduje, same thing. He did nothing in Kano, and his clear corruption allegations, which we talked about here, should not see him getting any public office. So as far as I'm concerned, I don't really know who else has been named that should be in the list. I would like to think that at least, given how he operated in Lagos, given the quality of people or some of the people that he worked with, that in going forward in creating a cabinet, he would lean on that history and have a blend, because of course he's not going to be able to simply say no to all the political actors, but he will have a blend of technocrats and political actors, at least. For me, that's the most I can give to him. But beyond that, let's see.
Thank you, Phoenix. Hopefully 29th of July is in about a week or maybe 2 weeks, 2 weeks from now. My math has always been terrible, but yes, in 2 weeks' time. We'll see who's on the list. But our time is up, so thank you, Phoenix, for co-hosting. I forgot to mention to the audience, I'm going to be away next week, so we might not have this podcast next week because I'll be out of the country, but hopefully I'll be back and then we'll continue the week after. But thank you for your helpful feedback. We see your comments everywhere, so promoting our podcast, and for that we are thankful. But until same time until 2 weeks, I say have a fantastic 14 days.
Thanks, Michael, and good that you gave the people the heads up, because usually you just disappear and we have to start looking for you. Thanks, listeners, and again, I can't agree more with Michael's comments around, and thanks to everyone for continuing to stay loyal and listening to us and promoting the podcast as your own. It gives us the joy to continue to do this, and wish everyone a great week ahead. Thanks.